if you think of self-actualization as closing the gap between what you value and how you show up, that's a really powerful lens to use coaching through.
Hello and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Alexi Robichaud to the show. Alexi is the co-founder and CEO of BetterUp, a mobile platform that brings together world-class coaching, AI technology, and behavioral science to deliver sustainable positive change. Alexi is also the chairman of Youth Leadership America. They have collaborated with leading companies including Disney, Google, and Hilton Hotels to coach and mentor future leaders. Alexi holds a BA in political science and nonprofit management with summa cum laude distinction from the University of Southern California. In this episode, I talk to Alexi about the future of coaching. There are countless ways to practice coaching, but Alexi believes coaching must be rooted in science-based techniques and reliable outcomes, which is precisely what they do at BetterUp. Coaching is not a replacement for therapy, but it can help individuals become more resilient and purposeful in their daily lives. We also touch on the topics of self-actualization, flow, languishing, imagination, and Alexi's vision for the future of coaching. I really enjoyed this conversation with someone who is really on the cutting edge of the science of the coaching profession. I'm sure you can imagine there are many, many coaches with all different sorts of claim certificates and qualifications. And what I really like about Alexi is that he makes sure that his coaches are up to date on the latest information and knowledge that can help all people thrive. So without further ado, I bring you Alexi Robichaud. Alexi, I'm so glad to finally chat with you on the Psychology Podcast.
Likewise, it's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, it's an honor for me too. I love what you're doing at BetterUp. I'm such a fan, as you know.
Thank you.
And I want to know more about the man behind it. I want to know more about you. Today, we're focusing on you. And, you know, I'd like to start with a little bit about how you even got interested in the coaching profession to begin with. Is this something that's been a very long time interest of yours?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think there's about 700 people behind it now, but I will say, Scott, we are a huge fan of yours too. I still remember when we were like a 10-person company, Eddie and I, voluntelling the entire team to listen to the Psychology Podcast every week. Yeah. So we could learn more. So thanks for continuing to do this and sharing so many insights over all the years. So coaching, yeah, I was really, I guess, fortunate in retrospect to stumble into coaching at a pretty young age. So I had some buddies in high school who got really excited about leadership development and what we called at the time life skill development. And they were reading everything from Napoleon Hill to Steve Covey to whatever books we could get our hands on. And my buddy John had this, I think what turned out to be a prescient idea to start an after-school club where we did peer-to-peer coaching and found local business and civic leaders as mentors to help us at this intersection of leadership and life skills. And so I was probably around 17 at the time, and that became a huge part of my life. So nights and weekends, I would be volunteering. We turned it into a 501c3 nonprofit. And throughout college, throughout my young professional career, I was nights and weekends continuing to coach and mentor. At that point, millennials and then eventually Gen Zers as they went through these similar years in high school. And so Eddie, my co-founder in BetterUp, his little sister went through the program. We had been friends at USC, but reconnected when he started coaching and mentoring nights and weekends with me with these students. And so that was kind of our baptism by fire, so to speak, in the world of coaching, and how in a roundabout way, I eventually ended up stumbling on psychology, positive psychology, and, you know, all the good stuff we're able to do today in the world.
Awesome. Well, what is coaching? How's personal coaching different from sports coaching?
Sure. I think at its very core, I mean, there's some similarities. I think at its very core, a coach is typically an expert at really a structured process of inquiry that's focused on you making forward progress to your goals in alignment with your values. And a coach is not telling you how to do it. A coach is giving you that feedback. They're giving you that accountability. They're giving you that support to really ask yourselves questions. There's a Socratic component to coaching of really like, hey, the answer isn't within you, Scott. My job as a coach is to unlock that answer. What that answer is your answer, right? It's not me to give you the answer. And yes, I think really good coaches do this with hundreds, if not thousands, of clients in their career, so they can pattern match. they can, you know, I know early when I was being coached, it was helpful to understand, hey, this isn't unusual what you're going through. Other people have gone through this same passage. They've come out with these types of outcomes or they've made these life choices. But that's where coaching's different from mentorship, let's say, or even therapy or high school, you know, soccer or football coaching. It's not inherently instructive. It's actually inquisitive at its core. And it's a combined partnership to really help you answer these questions in a profound way for yourself.
Yeah, I often hear sometimes the word co-facilitation used.
That's right.
Or a co-active process. I know there's a whole brand out there. I know.
Yeah.
Bill, there are a lot of brands out there in the coaching world. How do you know which brands are good, which ones aren't? Would you say they're all great?
I would not say that. So many amazing coaches out there. We do find that, you know, unlike something like therapy that is regulated by in the US by states and, you know, boards, coaching doesn't really have a regulatory body. And so it means that it's a low barrier to entry. There's nothing stopping you today from launching up a website and saying you're a coach. There's nothing stopping me from doing that. And depending on the type of coaching, maybe that's okay. But what we find when we, you know, to the heart of your question, what we really advise people look for is what you want is reliability and repeatability in coaching. And that's what evidence-based approaches bring. And so there are increasingly more schools of coaching, ways of coaching that are being informed by evidence-based psychology and other behavioral sciences. And those aren't being used in a clinical setting. Coaching is not therapy, nor should it be therapy or replace therapy, but using the science of positive psychology, the science of behavioral economics, sports psychology is a common one to pull from. There are still really research-backed techniques and strategies that what that means when you're working with a coach who's trained in that is you're more likely to see the outcomes that are being espoused. And you're more likely to have transparency into how you're improving and growing, which for me, as someone who is looking for help in my career as a young professional, still continuing to work with a coach, was so important to be able to like empirically measure how I'm improving over time as I'm making this time and this money investment in doing something like coaching.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the BetterUp business model. You have so many different types of coaches, right? Over at BetterUp, you can't pinpoint and say, well, we're all part of the conflagration model or whatever. I just made up something.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So we do. We have a lot of coaches. We're very large. I think we're the largest mobile network in the world, but we have over 3,000. Yeah. The team's
well done.
Thank you. Yeah. It's taken us 8 years, but you know, the team's done a fantastic job. Yeah. So we're about 3,000 coaches globally today. And we do coach across different subject matters areas, to your point, and everything from leadership development, really with a focus on the intersection of, you know, inspiring leadership or centered leadership, all the way to things like sleep or nutrition or coaching for new parents. And so in each of these different verticals, we really try to seek out or where we don't feel they're sufficient, try to create some of these more evidence or science-backed approaches to coaching. And so in our traditional, you know, executive coaching skill set that's often used in the leadership development, we're looking for folks who have some of the more preeminent international certifying bodies. And then we actually help up-level and upskill them in some of the latest research and science coming from, you know, these labs at UPenn where you're very familiar, to Harvard, to other institutions that are really trying to apply this in the workplace. So yeah, the coaches come from different backgrounds. What they all have in common is the standard paths related to training. And then at BetterUp, I think one thing we uniquely do is they're using standard measurements and models, which allows us to understand how people are growing, help people as a coachee compare yourself to folks who may be in similar industries or in similar growth journeys. But most importantly, it actually helps us give feedback for the coaches themselves on how they can become more effective. And I think this was the big kind of meta obstacle in coaching is historically, it's been a black box intervention. You're my coach, Scott. We go into your office together. We have a great session. But did that really work over time is pretty subjectively mediated by how do I feel? Am I feeling like I get better? As opposed to be able to say, hey, we're actually measuring these behaviors and we're able to comparatively look and see how you're improving to people who are making similar investment. And so that's really helped us create this feedback flywheel, both for the coaches, but also for the coachee or the member, as we call them here at BetterUp.
I love that model. And I also love that you continually offer them education, further education and the latest skills in the science. I love that so much. You know, I can't tell you how much I love that. Wonderful. Now, have you noticed a shift in the past couple years to a need for more of a mental health? A lot of people suffering at work right now. And I want to make very clear that there's a distinction between coaching and therapy.
Yes.
Coaching shouldn't serve that purpose of what therapy serves. But how can you still make a contribution? And have you noticed a greater need in the past couple of years that the coaching profession can fill that need?
Absolutely. Yeah. So to the first part of your question, Scott, we have seen a shift. So the biggest and most precipitous shift, which isn't surprising when we think about what's happened in the world in the last 2 years, is we saw topics and conversations related to well-being themes increase as a percent mix of coaching conversations and focus areas. People set growth goals in the application, as well as coaches actually code their sessions so that they can remember what was talked about, and we're able to, in a safe way, anonymize and aggregate that data. And that's been the biggest shift. Now, we've also seen career continue to be an important topic. So it's not like career and career advancement has dropped out, but what we've seen is that topics related to well-being have really shifted higher related to some pre-pandemic themes, which would have been very common, which were often like things like communication. Career stayed constant, but we've seen that shift. And to your point, I think this is where coaching can really shine. You know, if we think about therapy, and we were fortunate enough to, with one of our shared, you know, friends, Martin Seligman, write a piece on this. You know, if we think about therapy, therapy is a clinical intervention. It's really there for acute mental illness in many ways, and to help treat and address mental illness. But it wasn't designed for prevention. It wasn't designed to, hey, how can we help people cultivate, almost in the way of fitness or hygiene, or if you think of like a physical trainer versus a doctor, who's the physical trainer on that spectrum of our mental healthfulness or our flourishing? And that's where I think coaching can be really fundamental. It can help us cultivate these practices and skills which allow us to build our resilience, allow us to have better focus and energy, and actually allow us to almost have a stronger psychological immune system, to use the analogy. And that's not a medical intervention. That's like a personal trainer at the gym. Can I go to a doctor, a cardiologist, and say, hey, I'd like a workout plan? I don't know. No one ever tries it, but maybe a cardiologist would be like, I guess I'm qualified to give you a workout plan, Scott. I'm an MD. But they'd probably be like, you don't need me for a workout plan. Like, go get a physical trainer. They're more accessible. They're a fraction of the cost. And they focus on weight training and prevention. If you have a heart problem, call me. And so I think what's happening in society is there's this opportunity to, in a very honest way and a very safe way, say, hey, what is therapy? What is the role of therapy? But just because something relates to our mental health does not mean I need to go or should go to therapy. And that's not to say, by the way, that many therapists aren't doing coaching. In fact, when you break it down, many therapists are mixing in coaching in their practice. And that's appropriate. A therapist should and can coach. A coach should not and cannot do therapy, right? So there is you got to be careful which direction you go. But what a coach can do is help on stress management. A coach can help on reframing, catching automatic negative thoughts. A coach can help on thinking about what someone else's side of the same facts and story are and how that may make them feel. So there's a host of practices. A coach can help on accountability. Are you taking your steps? Are you walking? So much of behavior change. We know even the pitfall of so many people's experience of therapy is actually compliance and follow through, that actually coaching can be a really effective, low cost, and more accessible means of providing that physical fitness trainer to our prevention and to our overall health.
Wow, that's wonderful. And I'm interested in things not just physical health or even mental health, but I'm interested in things like self-actualization, dare I say.
Love it.
I think that this is something you care about too, is how can your coaches at BetterUp in the workplace and other sectors of society, but let's focus on the workplace for a second, how can these employees self-actualize more? Because you can have very happy employees that aren't self-actualizing, right? And you can have people with mental illnesses that are self-actualizing.
That's 100%.
Absolutely. Right? So both things are possible. So they're not necessarily the same thing. So how are some coaches at BetterUp helping employees and managers help their manager employees as well as help the managers themselves. They need help too, you know, self-actualize.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up. So fun fact, Scott, like the first thing I ever worked on with BetterUp, I was already kind of toying with and tinkering with the idea in my head. But when I started to write things down, the first thing I ever wrote on is, hey, here's a crazy idea. How come there's no company or brand that's focused on scaling self-actualization? And for me, the answer was the way to do that behaviorally would be through coaching. But the goal for BetterUp was never to be a coaching company. The mission of BetterUp is to help people live their life with greater clarity, purpose, and passion. If it wasn't such a mouthful, we would have just said to help the world self-actualize. But we tried to break it down a little more experientially of what that feels like when you're doing it. But nothing could be nearer and dearer to our heart than, in some ways, the spirit of Abraham Maslow related to, we are trying to, at its core, fundamentally help people self-actualize. So I'll just say that at the start. A lot of alignment there. And I'll put in a plug for you because you deserve one. If you haven't read Scott's book, Transcend, you need to go read it. It's awesome. It's I would call it a radical retreatment of Abraham Maslow. And I think in a really fun way, disabuses a lot of the cultural literacy around what Maslow is thought to have said, but probably didn't actually say, as well as applies in a really relevant and dynamic way. What does this mean behaviorally for my life? Like, what can I actually take away from this highfalutin idea of self-actualizing, and how do I show up in the world in that way? So awesome read. We love it here at BetterUp. I love the sailboat versus the pyramid. If you read the book, you'll know what I'm talking about. So check it out.
Thanks, Alexi. I didn't pay you or ask you to say that.
He's not paying me to do this, by the way. We're just both Maslow heads, all right, as we like to say at BetterUp. So yes. So work's a huge part of this. As you know, Abraham Maslow spent the last part of his career in Menlo Park studying work. And this is like the core, one of the core insights that we were trying to bring to life with BetterUp is this idea that management done well may be, for the modern human, the most scalable way to bring flourishing and self-actualization into the world. In fact, Maslow has this beautiful portion you're familiar with where he says, I've given up in therapy as a tool for that. Most people aren't going to go. When they do go, they don't stick with it. We know all the problems. Now, that's different if you're going for a clinical diagnosis. So we need to be careful how we characterize that. But for most people, his point is they go to work and they go home. And that manager impacting their life in a positive way is one of the most powerful intervention levers we have. And so to your question, how are we doing this? Well, we have to ask, what is self-actualizing? There's a bunch of stuff in there. But what really good coaching does, both if you're a direct report of a manager or if you're the manager themselves, is it helps people first, through a process of self-discovery, ask these intentional questions of like, what do I value in the world? How do I want to show up? And the sad thing I realized in my life is no one at work was asking me as an executive to ask myself that. And no one at work was training me as an executive to think that it was in my enlightened best interest to ask my team that. I managed productivity. But I was in a creative economy. But the latent management model I still had was productivity. And the reality is, if we want to talk self-actualization, so much of it starts with, who are you? What do you value? And are you showing up in alignment with those values? And whatever philosophy of coaching you're talking about, almost all coaching starts at that intersection right there of, Scott, what's important to you in life? And what you'll find is most people don't know. Most people, beyond some vagaries of family, which is really important, they can't articulate why they value this. Do you actually value your job? Is your job important? Or is your job a mean to the ends to spend more time with your family? Big question. And so going through this structured process, you know, Martin Seligman, Chris Peterson have the VIA character strengths, going through this inventory of what are your values that you care about starts to paint this pathway and this journey of, if you think of self-actualization as closing the gap between what you value and how you show up, that's a really powerful lens to use coaching through.
Wow. Wow. I've never heard it quite put that way before. It's beautiful. I'm wondering how BetterUp works on peak experience.
Love it. Well, I think you know David Yaden's a mutual friend, right?
Oh, so, love him. Yeah. I love him.
So we've done a lot. There's a great chapter in Peak Experiences in Scott's book, but there's a whole literature emerging around this. A lot of this for psychology geeks goes back to William James. So we work on them. We start probably on the spectrum with flow. So flow theory, right? Awesome. And I think for many people in a work context, in a performance context, I think flow is a great conveyor belt, revolving door, on-ramp, whatever metaphor you want to use,
agreed,
into the peak experience spectrum. And what I think you're getting at, Scott, but correct me, is the difference is peak performance can still feel very extrinsic. It's something you do. It's outside of you. Yes. Peak experience is actually about being immersed in something greater than yourself. And this is, I think, one of the counterintuitive gifts of Maslow and the whole humanistic all the humanistic tradition of psychology, which is the counterintuitive truth is you self-actualize by focusing on other people. If you focus on your own self-actualization, you're probably just going to be miserable and really unhappy in my experience. Been there, done that. It's a miserable place to be. If you focus on being part of a purpose bigger than yourself, immersing yourself in work that gives back to humanity, or even just your ecosystem, your neck of the woods of humanity, your community, what you find is you lose yourself in the work, you become immersed in the work, you enter a flow state, but to your point, you encounter a potential peak experience. And the end result of that is overdoing that for a long time, maybe a lifetime, maybe just a few years, maybe a decade, is you really start to become more truly who you can be in terms of closing that gap between your values and how you're showing up. So I'll pause there, but tell me. I mean, that's how we think about it.
Beautiful. I do treat peak experiences as synonymous with self-transcendent experiences.
Love that.
I do. And the peak experience is just a phrase Maslow used. So, and I like to kind of keep using that language. But he did often refer to the phrase transcendent experiences. He didn't say self-transcendent. He said transcendent. Because he viewed transcendence, as I do, as more of a synergy, like a synergistic, not a transcending of the self, but a merging of the self with the world. In such a synergistic way that you're bringing your full powers to the table, but what is automatically good for you is automatically good for the world. So just by your being in the world, you are making the world a better place. That's how I view transcendence. And in that model, it's you're not like diminishing yourself at all.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, so to get real philosophical with you, Scott, is it fair to say the latent mental model he's using, is this like dialectic? Is this like off-haven? This is like the synthesis? Is there like a Hegelian little thing in there?
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. For sure. And in fact, he had a phrase called dichotomy transcendence, which he said that the transcenders, by the way, that's what I call, I have like an 8-week online course, a transcend course. And when I graduate,
Karen's taking it. One of my team members taking it. She's loving
really?
It. Yeah, she's loving
Karen,
it.
What?
Yeah.
What's her full name?
Karen Lai, L-I-A. Yes. Yeah, she's loving it. Yeah.
Wonderful. So I have this transcend course. And when they graduate, we call them, you're now a transcender. So transcenders, a major feature is having this dichotomy transcendence where you stop seeing the world in terms of, in these black and white terms that, you know, you're either good or evil, you're either selfish or unselfish, even male, female, like, you know, we've all, you know, Republican, Democrat, you can go down the list of all the things in our society that at a higher level of consciousness, you actually can see how they're all part of a larger whole.
Yep.
So yes, philosophically, it's related to what you just said, but it's also just related to this notion Maslow called dichotomy transcendence. And I think Maslow at its base actually saw himself as a philosopher. That's my feeling after reading so much of his diary and things. He started off, you know, experimental psychology, really rigorous. And then he got to a point where he was like, screw that. Life is short. I'm going to wax, you know, profane about all this stuff.
But I think that's true in so many fields. Like the best thinkers in so many fields really are natural philosophers, natural scientists, when you break it down, right? Like they start to transcend, no pun intended, the vertical of psychology. And they're really just answering through that lens fundamental questions about what is the world? What's the human experience? How do we fit into it? I mean, I think of Martin Seligman as another one. It's like, he's a scientist. He's a clinician by training. He's a scientist, but he's also kind of a philosopher in a lot of his stuff. And so I think it's beautiful. It's beautiful when people, to your point, they're not bound by those labels and they're not bound by those dichotomies. And they're actually really asking these deep, profound, conscious questions. You get beautiful answers.
Yeah, I think that actually segues into a question I wanted to ask you. about all the places where this kind of innovation can happen and kind of thinking outside the box? Does it have to be the academy? You know, you're obviously not the academy, and you're innovating in the coaching space, if I may so say so.
We're trying.
So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how, you know, the nonprofit space, even the for-profit. Are you so horrible if you want to make money, you know, and help the world? You know, I don't, you know, look down on for-profits unless they're corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, what can they do to really innovate this field so they don't, you don't have to think like, oh, I need a PhD in coaching psychology to make any impact. In fact, that might make it less likely you'll make an impact. But who knows? What are your thoughts?
I have a lot of thoughts. So Eddie and I were doing, and this is why I'm glad you asked. It strikes near to my own experience. So I have a lot of thoughts. Now, they're my thoughts, so they may not be the right thoughts. But
I'm interviewing you for the psychology podcast.
Well, here I am. So I did this in the nonprofit world. So I think you're right. I think it's about intentionality, and it's about viewing what is the mission of the organization you're starting or you're part of, and what is the structure that best serves that mission. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we had to ask, I found myself asking when building BetterUp early on and just even starting to do the envisioning of it, it was like, should this be a for-profit business? I was doing this with Eddie in the nonprofit space. And we ended up where you were, which is actually because we wanted to drive more innovation, we actually believed the for-profit model was better. And coming from the nonprofit, it felt a little, at first, it was like, I wouldn't say it felt a little dirty, but it was just like, really? Like, are we going to deviate from our goal? And I think I had to eventually just internalize and be like, you know, I can take capitalism by its head or its tail. Like, shouldn't it be the case that if a business is innovating and creating more human value in the world, it makes more profits? Like, why do I assume that can't work in that way? And so I think what it requires, though, is a core part of your mission or charter is this realization that when we advance science, not just for BetterUp, but when we share that science, we do a ton of publication, we win and everyone else wins. And so I think that's something that we've tried to stay with high integrity towards is, yes, I don't know how many PhDs work at BetterUp. It's at least over 50. I mean, it may be near 100 at this point. We got a lot of doctorates, we write a lot of grants. We sponsor a lot of professors and research departments at leading universities. And we make that knowledge available. We do peer-reviewed journal articles. We write HBR articles for the business world. And so I think the answer to your question is, yes, you can innovate. I actually think in some ways, business can be a better platform when you need large groups of people, when you need quick access to data. Businesses can be a great platform to do research on. What it requires from the business, though, is I think a really authentic understanding that this is not a distraction from your purpose. This is synergistic to your purpose. And you're advancing your purpose as a corporation and humanity at the same time. And that's why you make that investment.
Right. You're not using all the money to buy a yacht. Yeah, I got it.
But even in your value chain, it's like, we work with Sonia Lubomirsky. We work with Martin Seligman. We work with Adam Grant. Like
you work with me.
We work with you.
I'm on your advisory board.
You're on our science board. We work with David Yaden, right? And I remember we've had these moments with researchers like you and David, actually. I think we're working on one paper. The team was with him. And to your point, they couldn't believe how quick we were able to date the data for this psychological scale we were building. And, you know, they were kind of comparing like, wow, in academia, we'd have to go get a bunch of college freshmen to come to a psych lab to do this thing. And with a platform like BetterUp, we can get this out to hundreds of thousands of members to do this by themselves or with their coach. And I think in that data set, it was like truly like a 24-hour turnaround to collect the data. And I just remember looking at this room full of researchers from Ivy League universities who were like, we've never seen something like that in our entire life. And so I think we all win. And so much of social science is really based on college freshmen, if we're being honest. I joke, but I know. Like it is. Isn't it cool that we're now actually able to base it on middle-aged people in the workplace while they're in situ in the workplace, not when they're at a university 100%. Reflecting on the workplace?
It's extraordinarily exciting. Yeah. There's no doubt. And it's going to be more generalizable. Trust me. Than just focusing on college freshmen. Like most like evolutionary psychology research is on college freshmen. And then they're generalizing to human mating patterns across human history. And it's like, do you really want to do that based on frat boys? But anyway, You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
I hope they're not like the college freshmen were. Yeah. We're not always a college freshman.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's not good. It's not good. So I love what you're doing. I love what you're doing. Now, I want to talk about coaching philosophy for a second. To what extent do your coaches over there take a human-centric approach to coaching? Because I, as a humanistic psychologist, I care very deeply about Carl Rogers' principles of unconditional positive regard, of active listening, the idea that in a therapeutic context, the relationship is the most important thing. How does that, some of those ideas transfer over to the coaching world over there?
A lot, for lack of a better word, philosophical or spiritual alignment. I think everyone should watch some of these Carl Rogers tapes, right? I mean, yeah, I think 100%. they're just not even managers, right? He's obviously doing it in a clinical, you know, setting, but this mm-hmm. idea about the regard for one another, the mutual regard. We look a lot at some of the research related to the alliance that came out of therapy, but this strength of, do I feel seen? Do I feel heard? Do I feel respected? So the answer is very humanistic in orientation, very human-centric. We use different frameworks. We've used the stuff from the Alliance. We actually used to, when we first built BetterUp, that's how we measured. We use those item scales to measure the effectiveness of sessions. It's just like literally like the most evidence-based research. We look at, you know, we like ACT. So we look at some of the, you know, we're applying it in non-clinical settings, but taking some of the spirit and the principles from that. We look at attachment theory. There's a bunch in there. And then we do look at kind of the canon, for lack of a better word, of some of the research that's come out around positive psychology-based coaching interventions. And there's some good work on how you can take everything from the gratitude exercises to character strengths and inventorying around that and incorporate that. But if I had to describe BetterUp's coaching as a philosophical thing, I would say it leans heavily, it's strengths-based, it's a co-active approach, and it's centered mm-hmm. around the human.
Great. That's great to hear. You know, so many people right now, it's not that they're having mental health issues, but they're also not particularly happy. They're kind of languishing, right? They're kind of like, people are kind of just like not excited about life right now. Can coaching move you from not negative 50 to zero, but from zero to 5, 10, 15, 40?
Yeah, it turns out it can. I mean, I think Adam Grant, another one of our science board members, did the world a favor when he wrote that New York Times op-ed on languishing. And I mean, we had been reading Corey Key's work. You had probably read it too as a psychologist. So Adam, I think, really gave voice and added, you know, this kind of like what to do about it layer to this body of literature related to languishing. And what we find in our data says about 50% of the American workforce over the past 2 years has been languishing. Not surprising, again, given everything that's happening. I wish we had been measuring this before the pandemic, because my latent suspicion is it may have not been that much lower before, right? When you look at some of the engagement in the workplace data. But the reality is, when you look at what I think Adam did so aptly, is what are like the micro interventions to unstuck yourself? It's a lot of what we talked about, and coaching is very helpful at it. It's about cultivating resilience. It's about focus and finding flow states to make work easy, to make work energizing. I think a lot of this is really about helping people remember and stumble back upon. It can feel like you're stumbling. It should be intentional. What it is to be psychologically engaged and get that flywheel of like everything from goal attainment to I'm making progress. You're really at the core, when I see languishing, you have a low sense of locus of control often, low sense of agency that you can impact your environment. And so I think a lot of it is like kind of like re-lubricating that wheel. And coaching is so powerful there, because you read that article from Adam, they're like very palatable, digestible baby steps. But I've been there. I have been measurably languishing. When you're in it, they feel like huge leaps. They do not feel like baby steps. And that's where I think a coach can be a really caring, but also a disagreeable giver, to use the give and take framework, and help on helping you bridge that gap. You know, how do we structure your time, Alexi, so that you get a flow state? Even if the coach isn't explicit about that's what they're helping you do, they know, like, really one of the great elixirs, the great cures for languishing is flow. So how do we help you slip into flow states, and how we design your work this week, or how we design the next couple months of your life? Then you get in that flow state and you're alive. You're alive, and you're like, whoa, I haven't felt this alive in months. And then it's like, okay, how do we replicate that? That becomes the coaching conversation. What was it in that flow state, Scott, when you did that task? What made you feel like, okay, how do we scale that feeling of aliveness? And you do that over months, over weeks. And what you find is you start to make a measurable difference. I mean, we see people improve their resilience 130% sometimes in their first year of coaching. And it's because, not because we have any like special powers, it's because we have that intentionality and that follow through and that accountability from an expert coach.
Amazing. How do you measure rate of change of resiliency?
Yeah.
How do you acquire that number?
Yeah. So we love the Fred Luthen stuff. Hero, PsyCap, right? We're big fans of PsyCap. We now use some of our own items. When we first started, the first assessment on BetterUp was literally psychological capital. I remember going in there and buying all the individual, it was like, you know, 40 users, buy all the licenses. And every time we had new users, we had to buy more licenses. And we've modeled, now we use some of our team has come up in our own whole person model with some, they are reliable. They work, you know, they measure similarly as PsyCap, but they're our own item scales. But essentially we've been inspired by the work that Fred Luthens and the team did on, for those of you who aren't familiar, HERO is hope, self-efficacy, resilience, and optimism. And it's one of the most workplace researched measurements of really these psychological resources or your ability to perform and show up in that way. And so we take the inspiration and the model from his work.
That's really cool. Well, tell me a little about BetterUp Labs. What's coming out of those labs?
Yeah. So BetterUp Labs, I mean, in some ways to your earlier question, if done well, all of BetterUp is a lab, right? Like we're creating products, we're innovating, but we have a special group of BetterUppers here at BetterUp who are researchers who focus on taking the data that we're generating, using the product, using the coaching, using all the interventions and experiences we're working on, and doing research on that to yield that knowledge for the scientific community outside of BetterUp and publish that. And so other people can benefit from the work we're doing together. So BetterUp Labs is really it's a research lab. It's also a brokerage with leading research things like the Positive Psychology Center at UPenn, Sonia Lubomirsky's Center at UCR, doing some of the research there. Scott, we've worked on things together. I mean, I'm not qualified to work on them, but the team has worked with you on this.
Yeah, like Dara Wolf and the creativity. Yeah.
Yep, creativity. So some of the latest stuff they've been working on, they've worked on everything from purpose at work, loneliness at work, actually, which ended up being prescient because we did that right before the pandemic. The most recent work has actually been on psychological perception, which Roy Baumeister, Martin Seligman have been doing research on for years. We call that future-mindedness in business speak. We find that resonates with business leaders
that's
more.
Better. And that's better, yeah.
I think so. I like prospection personally, but people, it auto-completes to perspective half the time, and then people get confused. So
why not just call it imagination?
That's a good question. So
that's what I called it with Marty at the Imagination Institute.
Yeah, maybe we should. I think what we found is business leaders still wrongfully equate imagination with fluffy, soft ideas.
You want to accomplish your goals if it only stays in imagination?
Exactly. They view it as like a funnel stage. It's the top of the funnel. I want the output. And I actually think John Seely Brown, who's one of our science board members and used to run Xerox PARC, has a great phrase, which is pragmatic imagination. This is what you're really after. But whatever reason, we call it future-mindedness. And that's been the latest research. And essentially, it's found where your questions are headed. Is, hey, it's a skill set people can learn and be coached on related to better creative outputs, better imagination. You can practice imagination, as we say at BetterUp, and you can get better at the practice of imagination. And a big part of that are skills related to, you know, not falling in love with your best idea, being objective, evaluating it. So the latest research you can read about it at betterup.com is on future mindedness and this intersection of imagination, creativity, and performance in the workplace, which is what we're finding is really resonating with what businesses and so many people in their professional life are struggling with right now in a supply chain constrained world, a macroeconomic downturn, yet the need to come up with new solutions is higher than ever before.
Yeah. So when businesses think of creativity, does the word innovation resonate with them more? Again, just for some reasons why imagination doesn't resonate with them as much. Does everything have to be so goal-oriented in life all the time?
For most business leaders, sadly, yes. But if they work with a better coach, they may discover that counterintuitively, sometimes just letting things be, you will actually make more progress. But yes, I think innovation is often thought of as the whole practice, like the whole kit and caboodle. The life cycle is innovation. Imagination, and again, I don't think it's right, but I think imagination gets pinned towards the start of that process. It's like blue sky thinking, let's be imaginative. And then it's like, hey, but we got to ship something. And that's not imagination. And to your point, actually, it is. It's a later life stage of imagination. As JSB would say, it's a whole different type of thinking. It's abductive reasoning. It's not deductive. It's not inductive. It's that Sherlock Holmes type thinking where you interpolate and fill in the gaps. That's actually the job to be done. And that's in the middle of that funnel. And we underappreciate that. But semantically, I think for a lot of reasons, people just anchor imagination as step one of a multi-step process instead of realizing it is the entire process.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you personally, you've done coaching.
Yeah.
Like, can anyone hire you anymore? You're like untouchable.
No. I'm unqualified. I'm no longer qualified to be a coach in BetterUp, which is probably a good thing for the world. So yes, in the earliest version of the product, Eddie and I were in the earliest version of the product, you got two coaches. You got a clinician who was doing coaching on well-being, not in a therapy capability, but they had that background. And you got a business coach. And yes, in the first version of the app, Eddie and I were two of the five business coaches you could have gotten. I still work with a coach. I work actually with the coach that helped inspire BetterUp. So on 8+ years with that coach. And then I also work with, so she's off the platform. She predates the platform. Then I actually work with one of our executive coaches. We have an offering for senior leaders. I work with one of the coaches on that product within the product as well. So as I often say, I need a ton of coaching. I used to actually have three coaches, but it just personally got too much to manage, like three coaching conversations. So I dropped down to two. But yeah, I need a lot of help, Scott. So yeah, I'm getting coached.
Are you ICF certified?
I'm not. No.
That's why you don't qualify.
That's why I don't qualify. Yeah. Or you can be board certified, and there's a European one now.
There are other things. Yeah.
But they're all the equivalent of ICF. They're peer organizations. Yeah. So I don't, unfortunately.
I got you. Now, do you miss coaching? Like actually having clients personally one-on-one? Do you miss that?
Well, my clients were about, 14 to 15 when I did it. So until we did BetterUp. So I do. I still mentor. And I think, there's some coaching that happens internally with younger staffers and team members. I coach a lot of entrepreneurs, although it's not, it's more like mentorship. There's some coaching in there because I know some of the coaching skills. So I think that keeps it close to my heart. So I don't like miss it, but I love it. I have had to, in my own work and my own coaching, realize that the best use of my time at this stage is not an hour of me coaching someone one-on-one. It's an hour of me continuing to scale BetterUp where hundreds of thousands of people in that hour can be coached. But yes, I mean, this feels like a coaching conversation in some ways. Like and I love it.
Am I asking you powerful questions?
You always, Scott.
That's a key of coaching.
It is. So yeah, I do miss it, but I've made my peace that I had to kind of hang up my cleat, so to speak. And I'm able to still channel that through mentorship. And I think in a way that keeps that part of me still turned on, like lights are on there. And I feel like I'm still doing some work.
So what do you see as the future of coaching? What are you most excited about?
I think it's embeddedness. For me, it's like, I've always said this. I don't know if you're a huge Star Wars fan. I am.
But I am.
Okay, great. So fun fact, I have a baby due on May 4th. So May the 4th be with us. So we're looking forward to that. But the doctor was like, I hope you're a Star Wars fan. I was like, oh, 100%. He's like, your due date's May 4th. I was like, awesome. Okay, so I often use this analogy, and no one's there yet. I think BetterUp's the closest, but we still got a lot of work to do, which is what we all really want. Is Yoda on our back in the swamp, right? We want coaching embedded in our context. And so much of coaching, and this is what frustrated me with going to therapy and coaching early on, is it was a destination I had to go to. And so much of context and so much of potential learning was lost in that journey and the time. You go once a week for 50 minutes, 6 days occurs. I kind of forget what happened. And then I'm spend 30 minutes of my session reviewing with the coach. And so the whole goal of BetterUp has, yes, been to expand access, but really to microtize coaching so that it can be woven in your context. So for me, the future of coaching, the through line here is embeddedness. How do we embed coaching where it's not just bounded in one-on-one sessions, but it can be through text, it can be through interactions, it can be woven in your life context in a way where you're pulling it in. It's not intrusive, it's not, you know, pushing you, but you're able to call on
There's
it
consent.
As you need it. Yeah.
There's consent. No,
I think that's the future. And we're not there yet, but like, how cool would it be if you go to your Alexa and start having a coaching conversation with someone, right?
Well, wow. But then that opens it up to a whole, even more of a wild west of unregulation and unregulated coaching. As long as Alexa is certified.
Well, Alexa would use a service. Like Alexa would go route you to a better up coach. So
I got right?
Alexa's just a win.
The middle woman.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just
the middle woman robot.
Just becomes the hardware. But imagine if, you know, you and your spouse have an imprecise interaction, as I like to say, or something, you and your partner, you know, get in a fight. Nice. And imagine if you're not talking to your coach for 7 days. Well, already with BetterUp, you could talk to someone immediately, which is a huge innovation. And that's just powerful. But imagine if you didn't even have to go to your phone. It could just be like, hey, you're in your room. It's like, hey, Alexa, I want to talk to someone about this. And you have that skill. And that's like, okay, what do you want to talk about? Just had a fight with my partner. All right, let's get you a relationship coach right now. Just right here in your cozy chair. You don't have to go anywhere. Let's debrief on that conversation and talk about that. So we're not there yet, but I think for me, that embeddedness, not for the sake of embeddedness, but for the sake of the immediacy and the fidelity of learning, that feels that to me feels like what we should be doing with technology.
Yeah, it the potential there seems really exciting. And, you know, especially when the metaverse gets more developed, or even augmented reality. Imagine, like, you know, you're walking around with these embedded glasses in your brain that allow you to augment it, and then you get like advice on, like, let's say you're on a date with a girl or something, and you have like a dating coach who's like able to talk in your brain about what to say. I don't know. I have an imagination, Alexi. I love it. Alexi, I want to end this interview by saying I truly, truly respect you and your work you're doing. Big fan of BetterUp. Would not have had you on this podcast if I wasn't, but I'm also a big fan of yours the principles and values upon which you apply in your life broadly. So thank you for being on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I reciprocate everything you said. You have truly been like a luminary in terms of, we've learned so much in building BetterUp, really from your podcast and your episodes. And we've really enjoyed the collaboration with you personally beyond that. So thank you for the opportunity to share our story, and excited to keep building the future together and using our imagination.
Yes, me too. I look forward to getting this episode out there.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.